it's time to read the Des Moines Register for today, Friday, May 3rd. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Lisa Horsch, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Judith Linden. For the first hour, we will cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and the USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Our weather today is a high of 74 and a low of 56, mostly sunny and nice today. Winds will be southeast 6 to 12 miles per hour, partly cloudy tonight with wind southeast 6 to 12 miles per hour again. Our weather changes a bit tomorrow for Saturday, a high of 66 and a low of 44. It will be cooler with a few showers. And then the rest of the forecast looks to have highs in the 70s with lows in the 50s. We should see the sun each day. It might be breezy on Monday and then expect maybe a stray thunderstorm on Tuesday. For precipitation, we had 6/10 of an inch recorded in the last 24 hours. And that puts us closer to our year-to-date normal, which should be at right about 9 inches, and we are almost at 8 inches. So we're still a little low, but we are higher than last year when we were only at 7.5 inches. Sunrise today was at 6:09 a.m., and it will set tonight at 8:15 p.m. The moon rose at 3:54 this morning, and it will set at 3:05 this afternoon. Des Moines Register front page headlines. They promised that they would take care of us 2 years after tornado destroyed home in Winterset. A couple is still living in a shed. And resignation rescinded. Sanders keeps manager post. And then for our Metro page, we have Des Moines Police Chief Wingert says he will retire. And there is news about the downtown farmers market that's starting this weekend. So here with our first article is Judith.
Thank you, Lisa. They promised that they would take care of us. 2 years after tornado destroyed home, Winterset couple still living in shed. And we do see two pictures here. One of them standing in front of the shed that they've called home. And the other one is showing a totally demolished home from 2022. The story is by Kyle Werner. Ryan and Mandy Gaines were loaded up and ready to go on a vacation to Texas. Outdoorsy types who loved to go camping and live off the land, they were set to go on a fishing trip for a few days. What they did not anticipate was the EF4 that hit Winterset that same day, March 5th, 2022, tearing through homes and killing 6 people. The huge tornado ripped through their neighborhood as they quickly scrambled to the basement. "We made it to the basement door, and as soon as I pulled the door shut, the tornado hit the house," said Ryan Gaines, recalling the grip he had on the door as the winds kept trying to rip it open. After what felt like forever, the couple went outside to see their lives changed. Their barn and hoop building were demolished. Their vehicles were flipped and totaled. Nearly everything they owned was flung across the street. Their kayak even ended up in a stream just north of their home. Their historic home, built in 1915, which Ryan Gaines had nearly completely remodeled, was still standing, but it was too damaged to live in. More than 2 years later, the couple is still living in a 14-foot by 32-foot shed on their property with no running water or electricity. Their fight with the insurance provider has left them with few options but to rebuild from the ground up. The tight-knit community of about 5,000 people has rallied around the couple to help raise the rest of the money that insurance would not pay. Volunteers will soon break ground on a new home the Gaineses hope to occupy before the next anniversary of the tornado. While the tornado approached the southern part of Winterset, the Gaineses went to the front porch to watch the weather unfold. Living between Madison County's rolling hills, Severe weather, like tornadoes, usually skips right over them. But as they and many homeowners quickly found out, this one would not, and the storm would become the deadliest tornado in Iowa since 2008. So the couple ran for cover. Ryan said, "As soon as the sound kind of stopped, we went out. I thought the house was on fire. It wasn't smoke, but as much dirt and debris was in the air, I thought the house was genuinely on fire. The air was so filthy." The house he lived in for 20 years, where he raised his three children and recently added Mandy to the family, was still standing, but it was not livable. A massive branch from a now-stripped tree had fallen onto the home. The roof seemed to have been lifted off by the forces of the wind and was put back on haphazardly as the tornado continued down the road. The walls seemed to blow and bend to the EF4 winds, which blew up to 200 miles per hour, leaving cracks in every single wall. The floor of the upstairs was no longer attached to the walls. An addition on the back was completely separated from the rest of the home. After the tornado, volunteers cleaned up Carver Road, the hardest hit area in Winterset where the couple live, in just a few hours. Soon after, the Gainesses looked to their homeowner's insurance for guidance on what to do next. Ryan Gaines said, "They promised they would take care of us." The company, Pekin Insurance Company, offered to pay for a camper for the couple to stay on the property. Ryan said as he looked around the tree-filled property, "They tried to get us to move to Des Moines to stay in an apartment, and that's a far cry from what this is." He went on to say that lasted maybe 4 or 5 months, and then they stopped making the payments on the camper. The Gainesses were insured by Illinois-based Pekin, which began to exit its home and auto insurance lines from Iowa in December of 2023. The company offered them $150,000 for repairs to their home, but they and a third-party surveyor agreed that was a low-ball offer. A structural engineer hired by the Gainesses said there was about $260,000 worth of damage to the home, $100,000 more than what insurance was willing to provide. Ryan Gaines also disagreed with some of the work Pekin suggested be done. He said about the addition that separated from the rest of the home, their fix for that was to put a ratchet strap on the wall and pull it back. That is not code. Pekin spokesperson Susan Grisler maintains it thoroughly evaluated the claim along with the Gaines' third party's recommendations. Ultimately, a court-appointed umpire, an unbiased third party, sided with Pekin's offer, she said in a statement. Chrysler said Pekin Insurance has paid that aspect of the claim in accordance with the umpire's decision and the terms of the insurance policy. "We thoroughly understand and respect the complexity of this particular claim because of our experience with catastrophic storm damage. Pekin Insurance Company maintains that its handling and payment of the claim is and always has been in good faith and pursuant to the terms of the policy," she said. So the Gainesses paid out of pocket to put up the shed to live in, which they still call home today. No running water, and heat from a wood-burning stove has become normal for the couple. Ryan Gaines said, "We'd like to tell you it's just miserable, but we're pretty humble people. We don't need much to be happy." And they still make light of the situation as much as they can. Ryan said, laughing, "I sleep 3 feet away from my toolbox. What guy doesn't want that?" After nearly 2 years of living in the shed and using friends' and family's showers, the couple realized they could not continue on much longer. Ryan said, "We finally realized the insurance company is not going to be there. We put a lot of faith in them doing the right thing, and it just didn't pan out. They made us feel like we were just trying to get rich off them or get a mansion, and all we wanted was a home," Mandy Gaines added. So in January, she reached out to one of the organizations that helped clean up after the tornado, Go Serve Global. Go Serve is a religious-based nonprofit founded in 2011 by an Iowa farmer, Ken DeYoung, and a missionary, Terry Baxter, after Haiti was devastated by the 2010 earthquake. The organization aims to deliver hope, spread the work of the gospel, and respond to natural disasters. Barb Meister, a domestic administrator with GoServe, was one of the people who helped immediately after the Winterset tornado. She has since been advocating for relief and aid for the Gaines family. Meister said, "Asking for help is the hardest thing I think we as human beings can do. They are extremely humble. I mean, they lived like this for 2 years. They just had to continue to exist because they did not have the means." With the help of GoServe, plans for a small two-bedroom house are going to become a reality for the Gaineses, who have since demolished their home. The new one will be built on the same site. Rebecca Hornback, a pastor with Foursquare Church in Winterset, who is spearheading fundraising efforts for the Gaineses, said, "They just want a house with running water and heat, you know. It's the basic things that we take for granted." GoServe had planned to start construction early in April, but it has been delayed due to rain. It does expect to start soon. Fundraising to help pay for the home has been a community effort, with hope of raising $150,000 or more. Jones Creek Apparel, a local Winterset business, set up a fundraiser with shirts bearing "I Helped Gaines a House," a play on the couple's last name. The t-shirts are available until April 30th on the Jones Creek website. A GoFundMe was created days after the tornado hit Winterset for the Gaines family. It is still open for donations. GoServe Global has also set up a fund at the Gaines' church, Reveal Community Church in Waukee. There is an option to direct funds to the Gaines House Fund. Hartman Auctioneering will host a live auction on June 22nd at the Madison County Fairgrounds Community Building. There is also a house-raising hoedown, tentatively planned July 6 at the Judge Lewis House Bed and Breakfast. One event, a fundraiser meal on April 14, raised $6,500 toward the new home. Hornback said, "It was good for Randy and Mandy to see that they are not alone anymore and that we are going to make this happen." Updates on the construction of the Gaines home and fundraising events can be found on the "I Helped Gaines a House" Facebook page. If you have items or supplies to donate or can volunteer, reach out to Barb Meister at barb@goserveglobal.org or Rebecca Hornback at WintersetChurch@AOL.com or at 515-462-1259. Ryan and Mandy Gaines lived together but were unmarried when the tornado hit. A month later, on April 23, 2022, the two were wed on their front porch, tornado style. Both rocked a windswept hair, and Mandy held a non-traditional bouquet of weeds and daffodils to symbolize new beginnings. The two have always lived self-sufficiently and hesitated to initially ask for help. Now they are seeing an outpouring of support from the community, and Ryan said, "We've always been the ones to help everybody else. We just have never had to ask for help."
Thank you, Judith. Resignation rescinded. Sanders keeps manager post. This is written by Virginia Beretta. In a 180-degree flip, Des Moines City Manager Scott Sanders has decided not to resign and instead will take on a big-picture role that allowed him more work-life balance going forward. Sanders, who has served as city manager for Iowa's capital city for nearly a decade, announced his resignation in a memo to staff in early April, noting that he looked forward to a new chapter in my life that fully prioritizes my family and my health. At the time, Mayor Connie Bozen said Sanders planned to stay through the fall as the Des Moines City Council worked on a transition plan and recruitment process for his replacement. But in an emailed message from Bozen on Wednesday afternoon, she wrote that Sanders has decided to rescind his resignation and continue his tenure as city manager after a month of thought, hard conversations, and an outpouring of support from the community. Bozen wrote, "I am grateful beyond grateful for Scott, and I am excited he has made the decision to stay as our city manager. I personally sat with him through many tough decisions and watched him as he weighed all considerations carefully. Scott has pulled together the support he needs to remain successful in his role, and I look forward to his continued strong leadership in the years to come." In a conversation with the Des Moines Register on Thursday, Sanders said several factors influenced both his decision to leave and then stay. After a decade at the helm of city government, Sanders said his decision to resign came because he saw a need for better work-life balance. He pointed to a growing number of responsibilities as well as major events that brought him to days with 7 hours of back-to-back meetings followed by 100 emails and a dozen phone calls, late nights and many cities Sundays at City Hall, culminated in a 60-hour weeks, inevitably taking a toll on time he spent with his wife, teenage son, and adult daughter. Sanders said, so it's kind of like it was never going to really be sustainable. The pandemic was kind of the turning point for which our community's needs obviously grew sort of exponentially, but also just the daily grind of operations. Then throw a derecho in there and public unrest and all those other things that hit us, what seemed to be like in this at the same time, was really the turning point where I stepped up and worked more, but then never ever backed off of that. The city is at a crossroads, he added. Since the pandemic, there's been a call for Des Moines to spend more time and resources on non-traditional government issues such as homelessness, food insecurity, and childcare. Sanders believes the city should be part of those solutions for those issues, but does not have the resources to take the lead. At the same time, Sanders pointed to a decade's worth of property tax cutting state legislation that has left the city grappling with what he views as a crippling budget. He said, sometimes we need to shake things up a bit to be able to get to that point where everybody recognizes that the heat has been turned up a little over time for a very long time to a point where it's something major needs to change. The city manager is responsible for the day-to-day operations of the city. According to the city's website, Sanders supervises department directors, serves as the primary advisor to the city council, directs major economic development initiatives, and is the city's chief negotiator. Bozen told the Register the city is working to prioritize and divide up some of Sanders' responsibilities among the four assistant managers to show him that he can have a better work-life balance. She said the position is demanding, but there are always ways to alleviate some of the burden. Bozen said, well, I mean, you're doing a $1 billion budget, almost. You have 7 council people. You have how many staff? It's not easy for any city manager, but he has a passion for it, and we're working out schedules, and I think that will make it more manageable for his personal life, too. Sanders' time in the role already has outlasted the average tenure of a local government lead manager, which is 6.1 years, according to a 2018 survey by the International City and County Managers Association. Still, there's never a great time for a city manager to leave, Sanders said, amid pending projects and upcoming retirement of some senior staff. Sanders initially planned to stay through the fall and even considered helping the city on a part-time basis. Sanders said the city council was getting ready to start scouting for a new replacement when he rescinded his decision to resign on Wednesday. The biggest factor for his reversal, he said, was the willingness of other senior staff to step up and free his schedule. In practice, Sanders said assistant city managers will be directly responsible for city department heads, including reviews and weekly discussions. There will also be an expectation for stronger relationships between assistant city managers, city council, and community members. Sanders said what remains part of his responsibilities is still somewhat in flux, but his focus will be on regional issues such as city growth, affordable housing, and the Des Moines Area Regional Transit Authority. He plans to continue working with community leaders, nonprofits, other local governments, and the county, state, and federal government. Sanders' salary will not increase due to his decision to stay, Bozen said, though annual reviews, which include compensation decisions, are underway this spring for the city manager, the city attorney, and city clerk. As of 2021, Sanders' salary was $284,268 per year. Bozen lauded Sanders' experience and said he has led the city through challenging times. His tenure has included successes such as the purchase of a disused nationwide insurance office downtown to provide needed office space and a new police headquarters with a cost that's anticipated to be far less than a new building. The cooperative agreement that led to the establishment of a city park on land EMC Insurance had acquired for a headquarters annex, it no longer needed, and the construction of the downtown Hy-Vee. Sanders also encountered some rocky periods, such as during the George Floyd protest, when he came under criticism, along with Police Chief Dana Wingert, one of his earliest major appointments. Bozen said of Sanders' decision to continue working at the city, "For me, it was a good day. And I think for most of the council, too, because I think most people see the work that he's done, the quality of work that he's done, and the progress the city has been making. And I think, if anything, we all recognize that." Judith?
And from page 3, several more local and state articles. Reynolds denies interest in education chief post. This story by Brianne Fannensteel and Stephen Gruber Miller. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said she is not interested in serving as United States Secretary of Education if Donald Trump is reelected, battling down a recent report from the Daily Caller. The right-wing media outlet quoted a Reynolds spokesperson saying the job is, quote, "something that Reynolds is interested in," end quote, in an April 22nd article speculating on potential cabinet appointments. Reynolds told reporters Wednesday at a news conference, "I am passionate about education. I am proud of what we're doing. I mean, it started with STEM. It started with registered apprenticeship programs, literacy, parental choice. So I've got a lot of work to do as governor. I love what I am doing, and I am really proud of the work we've done. But we've got a lot of work to do," she said. Reynolds said she thinks someone mistook her enthusiasm for education issues as interest in the position. She said, "The report said they thought I was interested, and that was, I think they mistook just the way I talk about education as maybe pick me." Reynolds has endorsed former President Trump's reelection effort after he became the presumptive Republican nominee in March. She posted to social media, "Joe Biden has been a disaster for our country. Higher prices, inflation, an open border, crime, and the destruction of America's image on the world stage. I will do everything to defeat him and elect Donald J. Trump for President of the United States." But the endorsement followed a tumultuous primary cycle in which Trump lashed out at Reynolds first for failing to publicly support him and then for throwing her weight behind Florida Governor Ron DeSantis ahead of the Iowa caucuses. Trump called Reynolds disloyal in a string of social media posts and threatened that her endorsement of DeSantis will be the end of her political career and that MAGA will never support her again.
New laws cover breast exams, biomarker testing. This is written by Galen Bakirier. Governor Kim Reynolds on Wednesday linked into law two bills making changes to health insurance as she continues to sign the raft of bills the Iowa legislature passed this session. House File 2489 would require insurers to cover supplemental and diagnostic breast examinations, while House File 2668 requires providers to cover biomarker testing for monitoring diseases and conditions. Here's what to know about the new laws and how they'll affect health insurance in Iowa. Breast ultrasounds and MRIs to scan for suspected or undetected cancer would all be covered under one of the new laws. Screening mammograms, which use X-ray to detect abnormalities, are covered under current law, but supplemental and diagnostic test screenings with MRI and ultrasound, which are often requested of women for follow-up visits, are not covered, leading to extra costs and for some patients with limited income, avoiding those screenings. The bill, which requires third-party insurers to cover those supplemental and diagnostic screenings, received unanimous support in both the House and Senate. Senator Sherry Lynn Westrich, a Republican from Ottumwa, said the other screenings for key in some patients, where an initial mammogram may not detect the cancer, an MRI is one of the most effective ways around for finding these breast cancers, even those growing in dense tissue, which is notoriously hard to image, Westrich said. Lab testing that helps track diseases and guide treatment would be covered by insurance under another law that Reynolds signed Wednesday. Biomarker testing for diagnosing, treating, appropriately managing or monitoring a disease or condition would be covered by insurance in cases where the testing had clinical utility. That would include any test approved by the FDA and other nationally recognized clinical guidelines. The law specifies that coverage should limit disruptions in care, such as avoiding unnecessary multiple biopsies, and that patients and providers have access to a clear and convenient process to request an exception online. Reynolds, whose husband Kevin was diagnosed with lung cancer last year, said they had seen the utility of the testing firsthand. She said, "We personally got to use it, so I can tell that it definitely makes a difference. It really ties the treatment to a specific marker. So it really does matter, especially with where we are going with the technology, innovation, and all the research that's being done." The law also requires the Department of Health and Human Services to report how many biomarker tests are provided and the total costs of the tests for those covered under state assistance. Both laws will take effect on January 1st of 2025.
Iowa law cuts local governments out of guaranteed income programs. This story from the USA Today Network by Galen Basharier. Governor Kim Reynolds has signed into law a ban on local governments adopting guaranteed income programs. The Republican-led House File 2319 prohibits cities and counties from participating or enforcing programs that make payments to individuals under a guaranteed income program. It was spurred in part by one such program currently operating in a trial period in central Iowa. Here is what to know about the law. The new law describes the programs as those that provide regular, periodic cash payments that are unearned and may be used for any purpose. It does not include work studies or required training programs. Republicans who backed the law's passage criticized guaranteed income programs as the wrong direction to take while addressing poverty and expressed concern that they would become widespread. Representative Steve Holt, Republican of Denison, called the programs socialism on steroids. Democrats criticized the measure, saying it undermined local authority and advocates' efforts to address poverty. Representative Beth Wessel-Kroschel, Democrat of Ames, said great things can happen at the local level, and this bill takes away cities' and counties' ability to solve local issues and perhaps lead us to better public policy. The bill would halt Central Iowa's Uplift pilot program, which provides 110 Iowans from Polk, Dallas, and Warren counties with $500 per month for 2 years. Payments under the program, which are unrestricted, are intended to assist Iowans in covering the costs of basic needs. Led by the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, Uplift is supported by Polk County and receives funding from 11 public and private sources. One of those funding partners, CEOs, told Axios on Monday that Uplift's scheduled 24-month pilot period would continue under non-government funding. The Harkin Institute's executive director, Matthew Reed, said in a statement, "We supported Uplift, the central basic income pilot, to find out if a basic income program would work in Iowa. To judge the program before seeing results from the research study is a mistake."
And now we'll take a look at Metro and Iowa section. Des Moines Police Chief Wingert says he'll retire. Law enforcement veteran has served the city since 1991. This is written by Virginia Beretta. After 9 years as Des Moines' top cop and a law enforcement career spanning more than 3 decades, Des Moines Police Chief Dana Wingert is retiring. City Manager Scott Sanders confirmed the chief's retirement on Thursday morning amid a conversation over his own decision to remain at the helm of city government. The chief's retirement date is unknown. The police department spokesperson declined to comment. On Thursday, Sanders called the police chief one of the most critical hires a city manager can make. Sanders appointed Wingert, 54, as chief of police in February of 2015. Wengert's tenure as chief includes highlights such as the department's acquisition of body-worn cameras in 2017 and the George Floyd protests when he and Sanders were criticized for the department's response and sometimes violent arrests of protesters. Mayor Connie Bozen said she was appreciative of Chief Wengert's service to the city. Bozen said she's proud of initiatives under Wengert's leadership, such as the expansion of the Des Moines Crisis Advocacy Response Effort Team, a program between the police department and Broadlands Medical Center where clinical professionals are embedded to respond to mental health-related calls. A former construction worker, Wengert became an officer with the Des Moines Police Department in 1991 at 22 years old after his wife Tammy filled out an application on his behalf. He said it wasn't anything that was on the radar. It was a forward-thinking wife. He previously had shared this with at his beginnings in law enforcement. He quickly rose through the ranks. He made senior police officer in 3 years, sergeant in 9, and by age 36, he was a captain. Along the way, he earned a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from Grandview University. At the time of his appointment, city leaders praised Wengert's police work and ability to build strong connections with the community. The existing relationships with the community and his comfort level with the community was a clear message I got, Sanders said at the time. With his established relationships, he'll be able to hit the ground running.
Des Moines intends to settle a 2021 lawsuit, discrimination alleged in the police department. A story by William Morris. Des Moines intends to settle a lawsuit alleging decades of sex discrimination by the Des Moines Police Department, according to court filings. The lawsuit, by three female officers and one non-sworn female employee, was filed in 2021 and was scheduled to go on trial next week. But on Monday, the parties filed a joint notice to the court that they had reached agreement for resolution of the case. The court filings do not specify the amount or terms of the settlement. City Manager Scott Sanders said in a statement that specific terms are still being finalized, after which they will be presented to the City Council for approval. Plaintiff's attorney Jill Zwagerman said her clients are pleased to resolve the case. Zwagerman said in a statement, "We are finalizing the details of the agreement, but we are hopeful that this settlement will implement much-needed change within the police department and the city." In court filings, the women alleged repeated instances of sexual harassment and discrimination from male colleagues and superiors, in some cases dating back to the 1990s. A judge in February ruled that many of the older allegations were too distant and too far removed from other claims to show evidence of continuing violations of the women's rights. But he denied judgment for the city, finding the women should be able to present allegations dating back to 2016 to the jury at trial. The city and court filings had admitted some officers had engaged in inappropriate conduct, but said the city had responded appropriately to cases brought to its attention.
Shop in the Sun, your guide to the Des Moines Downtown Farmers Market opening weekend. This is written by Kate Keeley. Shop local and enjoy the warm weather this weekend at the grand opening of the 2024 Des Moines Downtown Farmers Market. Tens of thousands of people are expected to visit the 49th season of what's considered one of the best farmers markets in the country. If you can't make it this Saturday, you have all summer and some of the fall to catch the hundreds of vendors offered at the market. Whether this is your first time or you're curious about what's new this year, here is what to know about this year's farmers market. When does it start? The Downtown Farmers Market begins at 7 a.m. Saturday, May 4th, and will continue every Saturday until September. In October, the market shifts back to 8 to noon. You'll find the rows of vendors and booths in the historic Court District in downtown Des Moines. What to expect? As many as 40,000 shoppers are expected to take to the streets of Court Avenue this weekend. There are more than 300 vendor booths ranging from farmers to bakers to artists and musicians. Wear good walking shoes because to see every booth, you'll stride 9 city blocks from Water Street to Fifth Avenue, as well as North and South on 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Streets. After the grand opening, the downtown farmers market typically attracts about 25,000 shoppers per week. Where to park? Surrounding the Court Avenue District, there are several free and paid parking meters, lots, and garages available for the day of parking. DART offers a free shuttle from May through October for public transportation to the farmers market. The D line runs on extended hours to service the market. Shoppers can park anywhere along the route to be dropped off near the market between 1st Street and 5th Avenue. Buses run every 10 minutes from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. The route runs on Locust Street and Grand Avenue from 17th Street to the state capitol. There are stops on nearly every block. What can I buy? Stock up for the week on locally grown produce, fresh eggs, baked goods, Iowa-raised meat, and more. Shop from vendors traveling across 50 counties and as far away as Nebraska or Minnesota. The Downtown Farmers Market will release a full list of vendors closer to the event. Find the perfect gifts from the market's selection of arts and crafts, garden decor, jewelry, spices, and more. Shoppers can pay with SNAP EBT cards and take part in the Double Up Food Bucks program. Every dollar spent earns up to $10 in money for fruits and vegetables. While it is still early in the growing season, this year will feature 12 new vendor stalls. Find them on Water Street just north of Court Avenue and south of the entrance to the Polk County parking lot on opening day, according to the Des Moines Register. Is there music or other entertainment? Yes, enjoy live music and other entertainers every weekend at the Des Moines Farmers Market. The opening weekend brings acoustic music from Fournies, saxophonist and flautist Brownie in Motion, Urbandale Community Adult Swing Band, Jeff and the End Effects, pan flautist Cucho Madero, Sydney Storm Entertainment, and Girls Rock. What's the weather for the opening? Saturday, we'll see a 30% chance of rain, but mostly sunny skies for the grand opening of the farmers market. The high is expected to reach 68 degrees, according to the National Weather Service. And finally, are dogs allowed? Yes, but dogs must remain on a leash at the Des Moines Farmers Market. Organizers ask you to review the FAQs before having your furry friend tag along.
Des Moines Plum Supply picketed after union rejects offer. This story by Kevin Baskins. A Teamsters contract with Plum Supply in Des Moines expired Wednesday, prompting members of the union's Local 90 to gather in front of the business during their lunch hour for a practice picket in preparation for the possibility of a real strike. The workers carried signs reading, "Just practicing for a just contract," as talks between union officials and the company continued with the assistance of a federal mediator. The union represents 28 drivers and warehouse workers at Plum Supply's headquarters in Sailor Township. The company, founded nearly 80 years ago, has 32 locations throughout Iowa and Missouri and provides wholesale components for plumbing, heating, air conditionings, and ventilation, plus pipe valves and fittings, cabinets, and countertops. The Teamsters made an offer to the company Wednesday morning that Local 90 Secretary-Treasurer Alano De La Rosa called fair and equitable. De La Rosa said the union was awaiting Plum Supply's last offer, which could be voted on by members as soon as Friday evening. The union overwhelmingly rejected a previous company offer of a 25 cents an hour wage increase, with 95% of members voting against it April 26th. De La Rosa said, without a contract, Teamsters can continue to work, but also could strike at any time. If the workers do go out, he said, it will be in the form of a rolling strike, where they do not show up on some days, but report to work on others. He said that would make it more difficult for the company to bring in replacement workers. Officials with Plum Supply did not respond to phone calls seeking comment. In addition to seeking higher wages, the union is attempting to negotiate over vacation time, retirement benefits, and what it said was the placement of cameras in trucks to monitor employees. De La Rosa said the union has filed an unfair labor practices complaint over the cameras with the National Labor Relations Board. Iowa Teamsters have been active over the last several months. In February, the union's Local 238, whose members include state government workers, staged a large demonstration at the Iowa Capitol against a bill that sought to force public employee bargaining units to hold union recertification votes before any contract renewal. The bill did not reach a floor vote. And in October, Teamsters Local 90 and Pepsi-Cola Beverage Company in Urbandale reached a new contract after workers, as with Plum Supply, voted down an initial offer and staged practice pickets. Despite winning a new contract, the local recently joined Teamsters in Illinois and Indiana in filing an unfair labor practices complaint against the company over work rules that prohibit workers from discussing wages, hours, or other terms or conditions of employment. Despite growing approval in public opinion polls and victories including the United Auto Workers securing a contract with automakers boosting wages and benefits, United States union membership fell to an historic low in 2023 at 10%.
Watch your step. Why do worms come out of ground after rain? This is written by Kate Keeley. Watch where you step. April showers bring May flowers, but spring rains typically resurface a more immediate creature that will help your plants bloom. That's right, we're talking about the earthworm. These little toothless, earless, five-hearted critters serve as ecosystem engineers and make for a good asset to compost piles. There are at least 20,000 different species, but the three main types include flatworms, roundworms, and segmented worms, according to Britannica. The earthworm, the worms you commonly see after it rains, belong to the segmented worm family. Des Moines has seen a little more than 2 inches of rain in April, according to the National Weather Service. Whenever it rains, earthworms will often appear on sidewalks. Whether they creep you out or help your garden, worms seem all too common after a warm rain. So why do worms come out when it rains? Earthworms breathe through their skin, according to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, so when the ground is wet, the moist soil can inhibit their breathing. This brings the invertebrate out from under the dirt and onto sidewalks for a breath of fresh air. Other theories suggest that earthworms use the rain for migration. It is easier and faster for worms to travel above ground until it dries up again, according to the Columbia Daily Tribune. How do worms breathe? With no lungs, one might wonder why worms need to migrate from underground to breathe. Earthworms use their skin to breathe oxygen. However, earthworms can still breathe underwater and can do so for up to 2 weeks. Are worms native to Iowa? No, the worms you see on the ground came from Asia and Europe. They were brought here through horticultural trade, according to the DNR. The Pleistocene Glacier wiped out many native worms from the Midwest more than 10,000 years ago. What other insects come out after the rain? Ants are another insect that commonly appears after a storm, only they aren't just on the sidewalk. They will often march into your house because they nest in the ground, according to pest control company Flick. Other pests that you may encounter after it rains include mosquitoes and mice.
Pleasant Hill waives some fees as tornado cleanup continues. This story by Chris Higgins. The mayor of Pleasant Hill has signed an emergency proclamation that will make rebuilding homes easier for residents impacted by the April 26 tornado, the city announced in a Wednesday news release. Mayor Sarah Kurofsky's emergency proclamation waives building permit fees for fences and accessory structures, such as a detached garage or a shed, that were damaged in the storm. It also suspends city code about structure replacement that does not conform to current city standards. The changes will make it easier to rebuild certain structures in the same location they were before the storm, even if certain city requirements for construction and placement are different from when the structures were first built. Kurofsky said in a statement, "The storms devastated an area of our community that has homes built during several different decades of city ordinances. We strive to make the process of rebuilding as easy as we can, by allowing reconstruction and repairs of pre-existing structures and fences in the same locations they were before the storm without navigating our current code requirements. Our community is strong and has come together to recover from the severe destruction, she said. Requirements in building, plumbing, electrical, and fire codes are still in effect according to the proclamation. The proclamation could be changed, extended, or repealed at any time. Pleasant Hill was hit by an EF2 tornado that touched down at 8:50 p.m. and traveled 7.7 miles with peak winds of 125 miles per hour. It lasted until 2 minutes past 9 p.m., according to the National Weather Service. The Pleasant Hill tornado left at least 18 homes with severe damage and many homes with minor to moderate damage. There was one non-life-threatening injury reported. Governor Kim Reynolds included Polk County in a disaster proclamation following the storms, which included dozens of tornadoes across Nebraska and Iowa. It allows more state resources for recovery from the severe weather, including the Iowa Individual Assistance Grant Program and Disaster Case Advocacy Program. The Assistance Grant Programs offers grants up to $5,000 for households with incomes up to 200% of the federal poverty level. The funds can be used for home or car repairs, to replace clothing or food, and temporary housing expenses. The advocacy program provides guidance and referrals to resources for those in need, with no income requirements. More information is available at iowacommunityaction.org. Crews have so far focused on cleaning up tree and vegetation debris, according to information provided by the city, and have hauled away more than 1,600 cubic yards of material. There will be multiple sweeps in the coming days and weeks through impacted areas to allow residents time to get debris to the right-of-way for pickup. Residents are asked to separate vegetation debris from other types of debris to help speed up collection. Trees and headstones in Oakwood Cemetery, off Oakwood Drive in Pleasant Hill, also were damaged in the storm. Once the cemetery is cleared of debris, the staff arborist will evaluate the trees in the area to try and save as many as possible. The city said in a Facebook post, "Oakwood Cemetery is dear to us, so we are using an abundance of caution when it comes to its recovery." The city will share further resources for those with loved ones buried in the cemetery in the coming weeks. Those who would like to help with the cemetery's recovery can donate to the Disaster Recovery Fund through the Community Foundation of Greater Des Moines. Pleasant Hill Elementary had light damage from the April 26 storms, including debris that flew in after the front door blew open, tree debris around campus, and a soccer goal that ended up in the street. Crews took care of most of the damage in time for school on Monday morning, according to Des Moines Public School spokesperson Phil Roeder. At least 10 students or families had damage to their homes. Community services have been on site, including the Spud Bus that offered free vegetables for families. People who need or are willing to provide assistance in Pleasant Hill should call 211.
And now we'll take a look at some national and international news. Riot police dismantle encampment at UCLA. Crackdown is the latest flashpoint in Gaza protests on campuses. This is written by John Bacon and Will Carless for the USA Today. Dateline, Los Angeles. Police in riot gear swept across or onto the UCLA campus Thursday and tore down makeshift barricades and a pro-Palestinian protest encampment that was attacked by pro-Israeli counter-protesters earlier this week. The pre-dawn crackdown marked the latest flashpoint for protests scattered across U.S. colleges amid mounting anger over Israel's war in Gaza and growing impatience on the part of the school administrators to allow disruptions they say make their campuses unsafe. At UCLA, officers in riot gear made several arrests and scuffled with student protesters who had enforced a strict code of no violence throughout the protests that drew several hundred people. By dawn, Police had cleared the plaza of the tents and plywood walls that had formed a protest camp for a week, but a smaller group of protesters remained assembled just outside that area. Political science major Jonathan Giang, 22, was sitting on the steps leading up to the Dixon Plaza, where protesters had been camped for several days. He said he heard that students were regrouping before heading back to set protests up again, but added that he hadn't seen much evidence of that. Giang said he had mixed feelings about the end of the protest. He was sorry to see the police clamp down, but he was also relieved it was over. He said, at least I know my friends aren't getting hurt anymore. I know students are having issues getting through midterms and classes. Now maybe things can go back to a sense of normal. After canceling classes Wednesday, UCLA required all in-person classes to switch to remote learning Thursday and Friday. The protests stem from concerns for civilian deaths during the Israeli-Hamas war in Gaza that began October 7th when 1,200 people in southern Israel were killed and more than 200 taken hostage in a Hamas-led attack. Israeli retaliatory attacks on Gaza have killed nearly 35,000 Palestinians, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, and obliterated much of the enclave's infrastructure. The resulting humanitarian crisis has fueled outrage in some U.S. campuses and spurred demands for an end to investment in Israeli companies. And in other developments, a large demonstration was underway Thursday afternoon on the college green at the University of Pennsylvania, where a Gaza solidarity encampment was set up last week. The school's public safety office urged people to avoid the area in a campus alert and said police were at the scene. Portland State University's campus was closed Thursday as police moved in to clear protesters from a library they had occupied since Monday. In a social media post on X, Portland police said 12 people had been arrested, four of them students at the school. Officials at the University of California and Berkeley have opened talks with student leaders regarding the encampment set up in front of the school's Sproul Hall since April 22nd, the Daily Californian campus newspaper reported. The school said skirmishes between protesters and counter-demonstrators Wednesday evening left three people with minor injuries. Chancellor Ray Rodriguez instructed state universities in Florida not to cancel or modify commencement ceremonies because of unruly demonstrators. He said, while we are witnessing a descent into chaos all over the country under the leadership of Governor Ron DeSantis, Florida has maintained law and order, Rodriguez wrote in a memo to the president. New York's mayor Eric Adams, in an interview Thursday with NPR, said more than 40% of those arrested at Columbia University and the City College of New York protests on Tuesday were not affiliated with either school. The mayor called them external actors with a history of escalating situations and trying to create chaos. CNN, citing an NYPD official, said 134 of the 282 people arrested were not affiliated with the schools. According to the official, 80 people arrested at Columbia were affiliated with the university in some way, while 32 were not. At City College, New York, 68 people arrested were affiliated with the school, and 102 were not, the official said. The NYPD officials told CNN the department was able to determine the breakdowns by cross-checking records with the universities. Pro-Palestinian supporters agreed to remove their four-day encampment at the University of Minnesota following an agreement made with school leadership. Interim president, university president Jeff Ettinger, agreed to facilitate conversations with the Career Services Department in response to the coalition's demand to ban companies that do business with Israel from attending campus events and participating in job fairs. Ettinger also will recommend the University of Minnesota Police Department not arrest or press charges against anyone on a criminal offense as a result of the demonstrations and allow organizing coalition to address the Board of Regents on May 10th concerning their demand for the university to divest from Israel. Northwestern University and Brown University are among other schools that have resolved the protests through negotiations. The Minnesota deal grew out of a desire among those involved to reach shared understanding, Ettinger said in a letter to the university community. While we do not condone tactics that are outside of our policies, we appreciate student leaders' willingness to engage in dialogue.
And from page six, a response from President Biden. Biden, dissent is healthy, but protests must be lawful. This story from USA Today by Joey Garrison and Francesca Chambers from Washington, D.C. After more than a week of silence, as dramatic images of student arrests filled the news, President Joe Biden spoke Thursday, condemning violence on college campuses while defending the right of pro-Palestinian protesters to demonstrate. Biden said, "We have all seen the images, and they put the test to two fundamental American principles. The first is a right to free speech and for people to peacefully assemble and make their voices heard. The second is the rule of law. Both must be upheld. We are not an authoritarian nation where we silence people or squash dissent." In unscheduled remarks from the White House Roosevelt Room, Biden called peaceful protest in the best tradition of how Americans respond to consequential issues, but said violent protest is not protected. He went on to say, "Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It is against the law. Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations, none of this is a peaceful protest. We are a civil society and order must prevail. There is the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos." Biden said he did not support bringing in the National Guard, and the protests had not forced him to reconsider his policies in the Middle East. Biden had stayed mostly silent on protests that complicate his reelection campaign as he looks to unify the Democratic coalition. On Wednesday, reporters repeatedly pressed White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre on why her boss had not commented on the impossible-to-miss campus protests. The president had spoken, most recently on April 22nd, saying, "I condemn the anti-Semitic protests, and I also condemn those who do not understand what is going on with the Palestinians." Biden reiterated that sentiment Thursday. He said, "Let us be clear about this as well. There should be no place in any campus, no place in America for anti-Semitism or threats of violence against Jewish students. There is no place for hate speech or violence of any kind, whether it is anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, or discrimination against Arab Americans or Palestinian Americans. It is simply wrong. It is un-American." With pro-Palestinian protests growing at colleges across the nation, Biden is in a no-win situation. He has remained a steadfast defender of Israel's war against Hamas, putting him at odds with many young progressive voters in his campaign against former President Donald Trump. For months, pro-Palestinian protesters have shadowed his events and coined the name Genocide Joe. Todd Belt, professor and political management program director at George Washington University, said Biden knows that voters aged 18 to 29 were an essential part of the coalition that won him the 2020 election. He cannot really afford to lose them, Belt said.
And a quick 50 states news from Iowa City. The Iowa City Public Library Friends Foundation and the Iowa City Landfill and Recycling Center launched a collaborative program in an effort to recycle books. Books in good condition will be resold to benefit the library, while damaged ones will be recycled. And in Illinois, we have from Springfield, under Illinois state law, to purchase Delta 8 users must be at least 21. But a recently released Keck School of Medicine study found that more than 11% of U.S. 12th graders use psychoactive Delta 8 THC in 2023. It's with these lack of regulations that the state legislature is considering a crackdown on the sale of these products.